Beware the leader who bangs the drums of war in order to whip the citizenry into a patriotic fervor. For patriotism is indeed a double-edged sword. It both emboldens the blood just as it narrows the mind. And when the drums of war have reached a fever pitch, and the blood boils with hate, and the mind has closed, the leader will have no need in seizing the rights of the citizenry. Rather, the citizenry, infused with fear and blinded by patriotism, will offer up all of their rights unto the leader, and gladly so. How do I know? For this is what I have done, and I am Caesar. Those words from Roman Emperor Julius Caesar.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or W201 CD88.1 in Ithaca. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. As Americans, I believe we stand at a turning point. The question before us is whether we insist on being the people of a democracy or acquiesce to being the subjects of an empire. That is the topic of our program this evening.
I never took from the widows and orphans, and never a hard-working man I oppressed. So take your pace easy, for home soon like lightning, we soon will be riding my shiny black bears. No fat rich man's
The question of empire is seldom raised in the mainstream press, which makes the article I'm going to read you that much more remarkable. It was published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on September 29th. The author is Jay Bookman, the paper's deputy editorial page editor. It's titled, "The President's Real Goal in Iraq." Bookman wrote, "The official story on Iraq has never made sense. The connection that the Bush administration has tried to draw between Iraq and Al-Qaeda has always seemed contrived and artificial. In fact, it was hard to believe that smart people in the Bush administration would start a major war based on such flimsy evidence. The pieces just didn't fit. Something else had to be going on. Something was missing. In recent days, those missing pieces have finally begun to fall into place. As it turns out, this is not really about Iraq. It's not about weapons of mass destruction, or terrorism, or Saddam, or UN resolutions. This war, should it come, is intended to mark the official emergence of the United States as a full-fledged global empire, seizing sole responsibility and authority as planetary policeman. It would be the culmination of a plan 10 years or more in the making, carried out by those who believe the United States must seize the opportunity for global domination, even if it means becoming the American imperialists that our enemies always claimed we were. Once that is understood, other mysteries solve themselves. For example, Why does the administration seem unconcerned about an exit strategy from Iraq once Saddam is toppled? Because we won't be leaving. Having conquered Iraq, the United States will create permanent military bases in that country from which to dominate the Middle East, including neighboring Iran. In an interview Friday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld brushed aside that suggestion, noting that the United States does not covet other nations' territory. That may be true, but 57 years after World War II ended, we still have major bases in Germany and Japan. We will do the same in Iraq. And why has the administration dismissed the option of containing and deterring Iraq as we had the Soviet Union for 45 years? Because, even if it worked, containment and deterrence would not allow the expansion of American power. Besides, they are beneath us as an empire. Rome did not stoop to containment. It conquered, and so should we. Among the architects of this would-be American empire are a group of brilliant and powerful people who now hold key positions in the Bush administration. They envision the creation and enforcement of what they call a worldwide Pax Americana, or American peace. But so far, the American people have not appreciated the true extent of that ambition. Part of it's laid out in the National Security Strategy, a document in which each administration outlines its approach to defending the country. The Bush administration plan, released September 20th, marks a significant departure from previous approaches, a change that it attributes largely to the attacks of September 11th. To address the terrorism threat, the president's report lays out a newly aggressive military and foreign policy, embracing preemptive attack against perceived enemies. It speaks in blunt terms of what it calls American internationalism, of ignoring international opinion if that suits U.S. interests. The best defense is a good offense, the document asserts. It dismisses deterrence as a Cold War relic and instead talks of convincing or compelling states to accept their sovereign responsibilities, unquote. In essence, it lays out a plan for permanent U.S. military and economic domination of every region on the globe, unfettered by international treaty or concern. And to make that plan a reality, it envisions a stark expansion of our global military presence. The United States will require bases and stations within and beyond Western Europe and Northeast Asia, the document warns, as well as temporary access arrangements for the long-distance deployment of U.S. troops, close quote. The report's repeated references to terrorism are misleading, however, because the approach of the new national security strategy was clearly not inspired by the events of September 11th. They can be found in much the same language in a report issued in September 2000 by the Project for the New American Century, a group of conservative interventionists outraged by the thought that the United States might be forfeiting its chance at a global empire. At no time in history has the international security order been as conducive to American interests and ideals, the report said. At no time in history has the international security order been as conducive to American interests and ideals, the report stated 2 years ago. The challenge of this coming century is to preserve and enhance this American peace. Overall, that 2000 report reads like a blueprint for current Bush defense policy. Most of what it advocates, the Bush administration has tried to accomplish. For example, the project report urged the repudiation of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty and a commitment to a global missile defense system. The administration has taken that course. It recommended that to project sufficient power worldwide to enforce Pax Americana, the United States would have to increase defense spending from 3% of gross domestic product to as much as 3.8%. For the next year, the Bush administration has requested a defense budget of $379 billion, almost exactly 3.8% of GDP. It advocates the transformation of the U.S. military to meet its expanded obligations, including the cancellation of such outmoded defense programs as the Crusader artillery system. That's exactly the message being preached by Rumsfeld and others. It urges a development of small nuclear warheads, quote, required in targeting the very deep, underground hardened bunkers that are being built by many of our potential adversaries, close quote. This year, the GOP-led U.S. House gave the Pentagon the green light to develop such a weapon called the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator, while the Senate has so far balked. That close tracking of recommendation with current policy is hardly surprising given the current positions of the people who contributed to the 2000 report. Paul Wolfowitz is now Deputy Defense Secretary. John Bolton is Undersecretary of State. Stephen Cambone is head of the Pentagon's Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation. Elliot Cohen and Devin Cross are members of the Defense Policy Board, which advises Rumsfeld. I. Lewis Libby is Chief of Staff to Vice President Dick Cheney. Dov Zakheim is Controller for the Defense Department. Because they were still just private citizens in 2000, the authors of the project report could be more frank and less diplomatic than they were in drafting the national security strategy. Back in 2000, they clearly identified Iran, Iraq, and North Korea as primary short-term targets, well before President Bush tagged them as the Axis of Evil. In their report, they criticized the fact that in war planning against North Korea and Iraq, past Pentagon war games have given little or no consideration to the force requirements necessary not only to defeat an attack, but to remove these regimes from power, close quote. To preserve the Pax Americana, the report says U.S. forces will be required to perform constabulary duties, the United States acting as policeman of the world, and says that such actions demand American political leadership rather than that of the United Nations. To meet those responsibilities and to ensure that no country dares to challenge the United States, the report advocates a much larger military presence spread over more of the globe, in addition to the roughly 130 nations in which U.S. troops are already deployed. More specifically, they argue that we need permanent military bases in the Middle East, in Southeast Europe, in Latin America, and in Southeast Asia, where no such bases now exist. That helps to explain another of the mysteries of our post-September 11th reaction, in which the Bush administration rushed to install U.S. troops in Georgia and the Philippines, as well as our eagerness to send military advisors to assist in the civil war in Colombia. The 2000 report directly acknowledges its debt to a still earlier document drafted in 1992 by the Defense Department. That document had also envisioned the United States as a colossus astride the world, imposing its will and keeping world peace through military and economic power. When leaked in final draft form, however, the proposal drew so much criticism that it was hastily withdrawn and repudiated by the first President Bush. The Defense Secretary in 1992 was Richard Cheney. The document was drafted by Wolfowitz, who at the time was Defense Undersecretary for Policy. The potential implications of a Pax Americana are immense. One is the effect on our allies. Once we assert the unilateral right to act as the world's policeman, our allies will quickly recede into the background. Eventually, we will be forced to spend American wealth and American blood protecting the peace while other nations redirect their wealth to such things as health care for their citizenry. Donald Kagan, a professor of classical Greek history at Yale and an influential advocate of a more aggressive foreign policy, he served as co-chairman of the 2000 New Century Project, acknowledges that likelihood. If our allies want a free ride, and they probably will, we can't stop that, he says. But he also argues that the United States, given its unique position, has no choice but to act anyway. You saw the movie High Noon, he asks? We're Gary Cooper. Accepting the Cooper role would be an historic change in who we are as a nation and in how we operate in the international arena. Candidate Bush certainly did not campaign on such a change. It is not something that he or others have dared to discuss honestly with the American people. To the contrary, in his foreign policy debate with Al Gore, Bush pointedly advocated a more humble foreign policy, a position calculated to appeal to voters leery of military intervention. For the same reason, Kagan and others shy away from terms such as empire, understanding its connotations. But they also argue that it would be naive and dangerous to reject the role that history has thrust upon us. Kagan, for example, willingly embraces the idea that the United States would establish permanent military bases in a post-war Iraq. I think that's highly possible, he says. We will probably need a major concentration of forces in the Middle East over a long period of time. That will come at a price. But think of the price of not having it. When we have economic problems, it's been caused by disruptions in our oil supply. If we have a force in Iraq, there will be no disruption in oil supplies. Rumsfeld and Kagan believe that a successful war against Iraq will produce other benefits, such as serving as an object lesson for nations such as Iran and Syria. Rumsfeld, as befits his sensitive position, puts it rather gently. If a regime change were to take place in Iraq, other nations pursuing weapons of mass destruction, quote, would get the message that having them is attracting attention that is not favorable and not helpful, close quote, he says. Kagan is more blunt. People worry a lot about how the Arab street is going to react, he notes. Well, I see that the Arab street has gotten very, very quiet since we started blowing things up, close quote. The cost of such a global commitment would be enormous. In 2000, we spent $281 billion on our military, which was more than the next 11 nations combined. By 2003, our expenditures will have risen to $378 billion. In other words, the increase in our defense budget from 1999 to 2003 will be more than the total amount spent annually by China, our next largest competitor. The lure of empire is ancient and powerful, and over the millennia it has driven men to commit terrible crimes on its behalf. But with the end of the Cold War and the disappearance of the Soviet Union, a global empire was essentially laid at the feet of the United States. To the chagrin of some, we did not seize it at that time, in large part because the American people have never been comfortable with themselves as a new Rome. Now, more than a decade later, the events of September 11th have given those advocates of empire a new opportunity to press their case with a new president. So when debating whether to invade Iraq, we are really debating the role that the United States will play in the years and decades to come. Are peace and security best achieved by seeking strong alliances and international consensus led by the United States? Or is it necessary to take a more unilateral approach, accepting and enhancing the global dominance that, according to some, history has thrust upon us? If we do decide to seize empire, we should make that decision knowingly, as a democracy. The price of maintaining an empire is always high. Kagan and others argue that the price of rejecting it would be higher still. That's what this is about. And that was an article titled "The President's Real Goal in Iraq" by Jay Bookman. It was published in the Atlanta Journal Constitution on September 29th, where Bookman is a deputy editorial page editor. Bookman concludes his article with the suggestion that Americans should make a democratic decision about embracing a plan of world domination, suggesting that our only objection to this course might be our squeamishness about becoming the new Rome. Leaving aside that what this plan boils down to is mass murder to protect the oil supply, Bookman's article fails to address the consequences for democracy itself. Looking at the model of Rome, one finds democracy nowhere in it. A senate of repulsively rich men presiding over a society of slaves and soldiers, and a violent and ignorant populace kept distracted by watching people dismember each other in an arena. This description already hits too close to home, as we'll hear from Dr. Michael Parenti, who spoke last week in Santa Cruz, California, at a benefit for Free Radio Santa Cruz.
I'm very honored to introduce Dr. Michael Parenti. He's one of our country's most prolific radical thinkers, has authored 15 books, and they are on such topics as history, democracy, fascism, U.S. imperialism, communism, terrorism, globalism, racism, gender, and class politics. And I would just like to mention also that having read Inventing Reality in 1987, when it first came out, I think, was it 88, that it made me the media activist that I am today. So I have taken what he talked about with the media, and I have turned it into my life work, much thanks to Dr. Parenti for this eye-opening piece of work. And it's still in print. It was republished in 1993. And he did Inventing Reality, The Politics of News Media. He's written Against Empire. And his most recent book is The Terrorism Trap, September 11th and Beyond. Dr. Parenti has also written hundreds of articles that have been published in a wide array of newspapers. And his writings have been translated into over 12 languages and to be enjoyed by readers, academics, social activists alike. Michael Parenti appears on radio, television, talk shows to discuss current issues and ideas from his published works. Dr. Parenti's talks and commentaries are played on radio stations to audiences in the United States, Canada, and abroad. In recent years, he's devoted himself full-time to writing and lecturing. Dr. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale University in 1962 and has also taught at a number of colleges and universities. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael Parenti.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I think I want to start by talking about something that we never learn in school, and that's imperialism. As Anne said, I have a PhD in political science, and it occurred to me that I never studied imperialism in all those years from grade school on. Oh, I heard about British imperialism and the Roman Empire and Soviet imperialism, which was going to take over the world, but U.S. imperialism, the term would horrify some of our fellow citizens who apparently trust everything their leaders say. I'm not one of those people who thinks that U.S. foreign policy is all mixed up, that it's all confused, that these guys just don't know what they're doing, and they're so stupid. There's so many liberal intellectuals who are never happier with them when they're saying that their leaders are so stupid, you know, so stupid. or people are hysterical, people this and that. They feel so good, you know. I mean, here are these guys who are sticking it to us one way and up one side, down the other, both ends, and you've got our friends talking about how stupid they are because the president flubs, almost elected George Bush flubs his sentences. He gets sentences mixed up. Big deal. What has that got to do with anything? They said this about Ronald Reagan. He's so stupid. They said this about Dwight Eisenhower. He gets all these things mixed up. It's time we stop focusing on how stupid these guys are and start focusing on how vicious they are and how relentless and what they're doing. So, imperialism is really the real harsher word for what is now called globalization. And what it really is the expansionist form of capitalism, of giant corporate capitalism. You got to make that clear. We're talking about the giant corporations. Because when I launch into criticisms about capitalism, I immediately get people, there are always people sloshing in bathos and start talking about, what about the mom and pop business and they struggle and they build it up and they create some jobs from some other people? Ooh. And I go, ooh, nice. I said, we're not talking about that. We're talking about these giant multi-billion dollar corporations that are not adding a little something to the community, but carving up whole continents and destroying our ecology. That's what we're talking about. Can we talk about that? Giant corporate capitalism. So that's what I mean whenever I say capitalism, not mom and pop and small businesses, nice little bookstores, which I want to support too. Now, we are taught a few things about capitalism. We're taught that it's a system that works, and we're taught that it's brought us prosperity, that capitalism creates prosperity. I am going to argue against that hypothesis tonight. One. Two, I'm going to convince you that that hypothesis is wrong. Three, I'm going to do that in the next 5 or 10 seconds. Almost the entire world is capitalist, and almost the entire world is poor. There you are. I'm coming to this other thing that I'm using that the media usually doesn't use. It's called evidence. Look at the world. Most of the world is capitalist. There's capitalist Indonesia. It's miserably poor and getting poorer. There's capitalist India. There's capitalist Thailand. Capitalist Nigeria, El Salvador, Haiti, Mexico, Brazil, capitalist Argentina, which is falling apart and unraveling, capitalist Russia, Poland, Bulgaria, privatization, third worldization. Poor, poor. The number of people living in poverty today is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. That is capitalism's expansion. That's capitalism's prosperity that it's bringing. Capitalism does not work quite well for the people in those countries. Now, that is also capitalism at its most successful. Because capitalism in Indonesia works quite well for the capitalists. It's just the people aren't doing too well. Well, okay, gee, I hadn't thought of it. And we never think of those countries as being capitalists, too. Yeah, all right, it doesn't work so well for the common people of those third world countries, but it's given us a good standard of living. Well, that, too, I'm going to refute. It's going to take maybe a little longer than 5 seconds, maybe 20, 25 seconds. Are you getting your money's worth or not, all right? Let's, in this country, let's put aside the mass inequalities. Let's put aside the tens of millions of people who struggle from hand to mouth. Let's put aside the many who live without real economic security, which might include many of us. Let's put aside the desperate ones at the very bottom. Let's even put aside the middle-class people who are getting ripped off left and right with their taxes and overwork and loss of benefits and the like. Let's put aside the impoverishment of the public sector and the destruction of a livable environment. Let's accept the idea that we live in great material abundance, which, in fact, compared to much of the world, we do. Many in this country do live well. But it wasn't capitalism that gave us this standard of living. It was the democratic struggle against capitalism. They didn't give us all these things. I mean, why don't we Americans work for 15 cents an hour as they do in Haiti and Indonesia? Is it because we're just so much more self-respecting? Is that it? No. It's because the democratic class struggle has advanced to a more favorable level. And that's happened only in the last few generations. In 1900, America was a third world country, half a century before the term was invented. We were a third world nation. Child labor was widespread. Poverty was widespread, 14-hour workdays, 10-year-olds working in factories for 14 hours, 7 days a week, no social services to speak of, a few church soup kitchens and charities maybe, no social benefits, typhoid epidemics in our major cities, tuberculosis and other diseases of poverty, no public housing or public health programs, very little public education, no public libraries, really. Advances came not with capitalism. That condition, that's what capitalism gave us. That's what the country was, a pure free market, unregulated, undiluted capitalism in 1900, but massive margins of profit, huge margins of profit, massive, massive, massive wealth for the Mellons and the Morgans and the Huntingtons and the Hartfords and the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Vanderbilts. More money than they knew what to do with. And you know what they wanted after they got that money? They wanted more, and they wanted more, and they would destroy whole communities to get more and more and more. Wealth, my friends, wealth is the most damaging and the most dangerous addiction that this society faces. It was the people, it was the American people, it was the working people in this country who fought and fought for the 8-hour day, who fought for public education, who fought for public health services. It was the people who fought for decent housing and a decent standard of living, who fought for a minimum wage, who have fought against discrimination. Name one great leader, name one great political leader, name one great great intellectual who fought and did those things. No, those people, they jumped on the bandwagon after the people fought. And it was the plutocrats, it was the capitalists, it was the economic royalists who fought against every one of those things. They fought against giving you a decent wage. They're still fighting against that. They're still fighting for wage cuts. They fought against Social Security. They fought against occupational safety. They're still fighting against it. They fought against environmental protections. They still are fighting against it, undermining it every way they can, because they're afraid they're going to lose out on a dollar. Because every dollar they've got to give to you, every dollar they've got to spend on stupid things like public safety and wages and occupational safety and consumer product safety, every dollar wasted on stupid things like that, which the free market would take care of, every dollar spent on that is one less dollar for their insatiable greed. And that's it. So don't credit the capitalists for giving you whatever modicum of prosperity you have. We got it despite it. We tore it out of their teeth and out of their greedy claws. And we still got to hold on to it, and they're trying to get it back from us. It wasn't capitalism that brought these advances. It was democracy. It was the people in action. It was class struggle. Class struggle, my friends, is one of the major and central expressions of democracy. That's what class struggle is about. When they get up, you know, they do class warfare on us all the time. Taxes, tax cuts for the rich, this, that. They're always doing class war on us. The minute we rally and we start attacking this corporate rich, they say, oh, you're preaching class warfare. George Bush, George the First used to say that. The minute we start to fight back or answer back, oh, you're preaching class warfare. I have another name for that. It is class struggle. It is class warfare. The other name for it, when people become the active social agents of their own lives and go out and protest and try to better their lives, that another name for that is called democracy. And they wouldn't recognize it if you slap them right in the face with it. They wouldn't know what it is. And it was these economic royalists, the rich bankers, the merchant class, the slaveholders, they fought against political democracy as well as economic democracy. They fought against the elimination of property qualifications for voters and office holders. After all, they put that into the laws. They put that into the laws, those property qualifications. Those were their laws. They fought against extending the vote, universal suffrage for working men in the 1820s and 30s. They fought against suffrage for women. They fought against the abolition of slavery and Jim Crow. They fought against honest elections and democratic ballot access and proportional representation and campaign finance reform and securing civil liberties. And they're still fighting against it. Do you have the evidence? Have I proven my case? Just go out and look at it all. That's what they're doing. Political and economic democracy are the things that they fear the most. Democracy is always under siege and always endangered by plutocracy. So when we say that capitalism works or it doesn't work, we must specify for whom. Because capitalism doesn't work all that well. Giant corporate finance capital doesn't work all that well for third world nations. It doesn't work all that well for other people. But it works quite well for the capitalists. The rate of capital accumulation per dollar invested is much higher in third world countries. The public sector is smaller or non-existent. Regulation is less, non-existent in many cases. The goal is to get us all back to the third world. The dream is to get all of North America and Denmark and Sweden and Western Europe and such, get it all back, get them all working as hard as the people do in Indonesia. Oh, who's going to buy all this stuff? Oh, you'll buy. You may have to buy less. You just have to work twice as hard to buy. Do you work twice as hard to buy that pair of shoes? I make that much more on those shoes. So they're working very hard to get us back to 1900. To achieve all this, the U.S. globalists have been the greatest purveyors of state-sponsored terrorism the world has ever seen. U.S. national security state has supported and financed Muslim terrorists in Afghanistan, in Bosnia and Kosovo, against a democratically and elected multi-party Yugoslavian government in Bosnia and Kosovo, in various other countries. U.S. operatives have worked with death squads, torturers, drug traffickers in countries too numerous to list here. You know, not long after September 11 and when Bush decided to target Afghanistan, someone remarked, almost in passing, like a throwaway line, said, well, the CIA has close links with the anti-Taliban groups and also with the Taliban groups. CIA has close links with both those groups and has had some links with Al-Qaeda. I mean, just interesting toss-away line. Nobody said, well, how come? What's that all about? All of this is a matter of public record. All of it is largely ignored by the corporate media. Very little of it is known by the general public. Since World War II, the U.S. national security state has been a key force in overthrowing popular governments in Guatemala, Guyana, Brazil, Chile, Iran under Mossadegh, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece twice, Argentina twice, Haiti, Bolivia, and other countries too numerous to mention. And replacing them with pro-capitalist military regimes that opened up their markets, their resources, their cheap labor to Western corporate investors on terms that were completely favorable to the investors. In those years, the U.S. has launched terrorist, state-sponsored terrorist attacks and proxy mercenary wars in Angola, 2 million dead, Mozambique, 900,000 killed, the Renamo murderers, CIA trained and financed. How many of us read large, copious, penetrating articles about these things? Did the media provide that for us? I don't think so. Ethiopia, Portugal, South Yemen, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, Egypt, Lebanon, Peru, Iran, Zaire, Indonesia, Jamaica, the Fiji Islands, and other countries. These lists are not exhaustive. I'm just giving you the names I jotted down from my own memory. In the last 3 decades, U.S. forces have launched aerial attacks or direct military actions with U.S. forces. Now we're talking about U.S. missiles, U.S. forces, not just U.S. weapons in the hands of mercenary or comprador groups, but U.S. forces directly. In violation of U.N. charter and international law, including invasions against Vietnam, Dominican Republic, North Korea, invasions or attacks, I'm saying, Laos, Cambodia, Haiti, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, and Yugoslavia. There's no rogue state. There's no communist state that has a record like that in these last 3 decades. The number of countries invaded, bombed, large numbers of people killed and destroyed. When this George Bush talks about bombing Iraq, bombing, taking action, the euphemistic terms, we may have to take action. We have to take action. We're looking at this operation against Iraq. You see the sanitizing, normalizing terms that are being used. This move, we have to make our move against Saddam Hussein. It's not against Saddam Hussein, it's against the Iraqi people. They won't send troops in there until they bombed and blasted and destroyed and leveled Baghdad. Do you know who lives in Baghdad? Children live in Baghdad. I was just there 2 years ago. Children. Lovely, nice, little, friendly children. Mothers, grandmothers, young men, young women, old women, people who have every right to be alive, just as much as us, who've never done anything. Many of them don't even know or care where the United States is and have never created any injury against this country, nor has their country as a political entity ever committed any injury. So there's no communist country or so-called rogue state or axis of evil. There's no evil axis country that has this record of violent aggression, mass destruction, and violation of international law. Today, the U.S. neo-colonial empire, it's a neo-imperialism. You understand the difference between imperialism and neo-imperialism. Our empire, the British Empire, when I was a kid, you used to take a globe and you could see all this pink all over the globe. That was the British Empire. And you say, my gosh, where you went and you planted the Union Jack and all that. 50 years before the Brits thought of doing this in India, the U.S. had devised a new form of imperialism. And they did it in Cuba. In about 1902, they went to Cuba in 1904 and they said, look, we just stole you fair and square from the Spaniards, who were willing to negotiate a settlement and leave, but we didn't want them to leave. We wanted to have a war so we could have an excuse to take not only Cuba, but Puerto Rico and Guam and the Philippines. So we got you now, but it doesn't look so good. We're a republic having colonies. In fact, I never had colonies. Another thing, when I was a kid in school, they were called territories. The U.S. had territories, different places, not too many of them. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you Cubans your independence. We're going to give you your own constitution. In fact, here it is. And check the spelling, because our Spanish isn't that good. And you're going to have your own presidente, and you're going to have your own currency, money, and you can put anybody you want on the dollar bills. You can put Jose Marti if you want. It doesn't have to be George Washington. Hey, we're flex. You're going to have your own flag. It's going to be red, white, and blue. But you have only one star on it because you're just a little island. You know. And for all of this, all we get in return, all we get in our usual selfless way, is we will just own your sugar industry, your tobacco industry, your nickel mining, your oil refineries, and we'll control all your exports and imports, and we have control of all your relations with third nations. So you're independent now. There you go. They did that, you know, they did that half a century before the British thought of doing it elsewhere. So we have all these independent countries whose militaries we support, whose markets we control, who we can bring to their knees with the threat of sanctions and the like. 300 major military bases all over the world. We need them, Dick Cheney says. We need them because there are other enemies. With the overthrow of communism, there was a sudden panic, an enemy shortage they had in Washington. What do we do? Because the only way the empire can exist, the empire exists by feeding off the republic. It uses the resources of the republic so that patricians can pursue their far-off plunder. They need your taxes, they need your resources, they need your sons and daughters so that they can go and do these things. And to do that, the only way they can do that is by convincing you this is for your interest, your security, your safety, because there's a world out there of terrible threats and such. Now, so we need all these bases and all that because there's a world out there that threatens us. Why don't they threaten Denmark or Luxembourg or Sweden or one of these, or Spain? Or, I don't know. Well, in fact, it does happen. They do threaten. Because as the U.S. successfully, the U.S. national security state, and I don't say U.S., I don't say we. As we go into these countries and we do this, it's not we, okay? Stop the we-ing. It's not we. It's they who are doing it. When you say we, you create a community of interest between us and them. Let's at least, this first step toward our liberation and our struggle, let's at least get back the right vocabulary and not let them using it. When we say we go in there and we kill people in this country and we kill, you're creating a community of interest with the killers. And we aren't doing that. Plus, you deprive yourselves of our own we. I heard one noted activist and leader, I won't mention her name, in the same sentence she said, it's terrible what we are doing in Central America and we have to fight against what we're doing there. You know, we've run out of we's after a while. It's what they are doing. And the U.S., I forgot what I was saying. What was I talking about before that? That's the trouble when you digress from your digressions. I can't get back to where I was. What? Wait a minute, wait. Yes. Sounds like. Neo-imperialism. No, we've already done neo-imperialism. All right, you're getting out of hand now. Stop it. Right. All right, that is the point, right, that the U.S. has been destroying democratic movements. U.S. leaders have been destroying democratic movements throughout the Middle East, in Syria, in Egypt, in Yemen, in Iran, and Iraq. Democratic popular movements in Turkey, country after country, one country after another, those democratic movements have been repressed. The only channel they've got left is this Islamic, ultra-nationalist, right-wing expression. And that's the route they take. And so then, we American citizens, we become the targets of their terrorism, as happened a year ago, September 11. Now that September 11, which many of us looked at and saw it as a horrible event, the people who are running this country now looked at that as a golden opportunity. That's not my speculation. On September 14, I heard President-elect George Bush say, this may prove to be an opportunity, a really important opportunity. Remember those wonderful things he was saying? This is the first, it's going to be the first war of the 21st century. The first war, yay! Instead of saying this should be a century of no war, or this should be the last war, or let's try to avoid war in this new century, saying this is going to be the first war and something to look forward to, all those other wars. And this has defined my administration now. He saw the peg. He saw this opening. And that became... And so we got this kind of incredible hype and whatever else that developed from that, which continued right to this September 11. Remember this just recent September 11? I had to watch it on TV because I'm a media critic, you see. And I got two radio shows I had to do that day. And one of them explicitly said, we'd like you to comment on the media's coverage of, you know, the one-year anniversary. I said, oh, Jesus. I knew what I was going to have to do. I had to get up. And I sat there and put the TV on like a kid not wanting to do his homework, you know, watching this pain, looking at the stuff. And who do I see but Barbara Walters? You know, Barbara Wawa, and she's got seven 9/11 widows, these women who lost their husbands on 9/11, and she's asking them questions like, do you miss your husband? Or, when you think of your husband, do you feel pleasure or pain? I'm going, oh, Jesus. And then she sees a little four-year-old kid, and she says, do you remember your daddy? What did you like the most about your daddy? And that was when I really almost lost it, you know. I mean, lunch, almost lost. And so I shut the TV rather than put my foot through it, which wouldn't be such a bad idea, but I'm a media critic. I need my TV. So. Now, the goal of all this imperialism is a very consistent and very rational goal. The countries, the movements, the leaders that are acted against are those who try to develop things in a different way. The countries, the movements, and the leaders who get U.S. support are those who foster the interests of the Fortune 500. The basic struggle is between those who think that the land, the labor, the resources, the natural resources, and the markets of the world should be there for the benefit of capital accumulation, for the benefit of a few, as against those who think that the land, the labor, and the natural resources and the capital of the world should be there for the development of human communities and human needs. That is the basic struggle that's going on here. And that global empire is there to make sure that those resources go to that first option, to prevent competing forms of economic governance. And that's every country, every leader who's been hit has been guilty of that. Right today you see it in Colombia. Right today you see it. Who's being targeted? Who's being maligned most vigorously of all the Latin American leaders? Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Why? Because he's doing a little something. He's taking a little something from the rich and he's giving it to the poor. He's opening up clinics. He's opening up schools that kids can go to. He's eliminated the school fee so that children of families who never dreamed they could send their kids to school are now sending their kids to school. He's trying to clean up communities. He's putting through job programs and the like. So Hugo Chavez is now maligned. He's called a demagogue. He's called a power crazy, erratic. He's got all sorts of personality problems, apparently. So the goal is to prevent competing centers of development. The goal is to prevent systems from developing that offer an alternative approach to the use of the world's resources and labor. The goal now, with the overthrow of communism, the goal now is to prevent also competing centers of capitalist development. The goal now is to really stick it to the working classes of all these countries that have won all these democratic gains, many of which the plutocrats have had to give them out of fear of communism, to sell it to them, to say, you know, see, you've got so much better life than the people over there in those countries do. You're so much better off and all. Now we don't have to say that anymore. Say, look what's happening in Russia. People have been reduced to beggary. Human services have been pretty much abolished. All the public-owned industries are being privatized, all that. Why should we have to tolerate any of that stuff here? Now we're going to stick it to the working class. You people are going to work harder and harder. We're going to get you back to 1900. That is their goal. And the goal against third world nations was much the same. Often aid was given to third world nations, an attempt to develop a middle class in these nations, stability to make sure some level of prosperity, some little visibility points of prosperity, so that these countries, what? Would not go communist. Now they got nowhere else to go. Those programs are being dropped. Aid is being cut back, or aid is being used for the plutocrats in those countries to help pay their particular infrastructures and the like. So the goal now is really to stop competing forms of capitalism. The goal is to create, as Haas and Pearl and Elliot Abrams and Condoleezza Rice and others have said, is to prevent another superpower from emerging. But I would say it's also to prevent any regional powers from emerging. It's also to prevent any viable, prosperous, self-developing countries from emerging, countries that might challenge our markets, countries that might really develop their own way and go their own way. There was one troublesome country back in the 1990s, even after the overthrow of communism, and that was Yugoslavia, right there in the middle of Europe, a rather large country with 80% of its economy publicly owned still, with a level of prosperity, uneven and all that, inequalities, highly imperfect society, but a level of prosperity that was still very high. A country that had no interest in joining NATO, had no interest in joining the European Union. It had to be broken up, and it was targeted, and it was torn apart, and ethnic enmities were incited, and Yugoslavia was broken up into a bunch of small, little, weak principalities, republics, money-driven, West-dominated republics. And privatization started. Everything's been privatized now in Macedonia. Everything's been privatized in Bosnia. Everything's soon to be privatized in the rest of Yugoslavia, which is just Serbia and Montenegro now. So there it is. Prevent self-defining countries like Iraq. Lots of oil, high quality. Iraq is the one country in the Middle East that has is rich both in oil and water. Some of them have water, no oil. Some have oil, no water. Iraq had a good agricultural base, an excellent one, which has been ruined by depleted uranium all through the Basra region and everywhere else. Iraq had a standard of living that was the highest in the Middle East, even though it was being run by a right-wing slime ball named Saddam Hussein, who was put in by the CIA. The goal is to keep the region powerless. Iraq was proving to be a self-defining country, and that is not to be tolerated anymore.